This programme was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.mpr.nz/donate.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Bob Stewart,
Bruce Macwell,
and I'm Stuart Brooks.
Bob, I'd just like to ask you, following on from our earlier little talk, moving around the world like you have within certain limits, you know, the States and back to New Zealand and back to the States and then to Fiji and so forth. How did you find all that, and you know, what made you sort of come back to New Zealand again to finish it all up, if you like?
Well, very good question. I think I became quite convinced that as a result of my AFS year as a 17-year-old in the States, that I really wanted to taste, as a lot of young people feel this, they really want to see what's out there, you know. And so it was very, very strong with me, and I thought, well, I can combine it not just as a sort of gap year, but I can actually be doing stuff that will help me in my future. And so after I got my came back from my AFS year, which was a magnificent year, as I've indicated in the first recording, as I was doing my university at Victoria, I was also teaching, you know, looking to for possibilities to go back to the North America, and that was really where I wanted to go back initially. I didn't have much interest in going to UK because I felt I'd had UK pushed down my throat at my boarding school, which I didn't particularly enjoy. But United States seemed just so much more human and positive and stimulating. So indeed, I got a scholarship and went back there and travelled by boat, which in itself was quite an experience in those days. 6 weeks travel cruise across the Pacific, and had 2 great years in Ohio in a university there, or a college. And part of what I did was apply for postgrad work, or as they call graduate work, to do a master's or PhD, whichever. So, as I indicated before, I got into to Harvard.
And so, what were you doing in Ohio then? You were working there?
I was doing really basically. Because at one of the questions which I had for myself is, do I want to do medicine or do I want to do psychology? And in those days, the profession of clinical psychology and so on, counselling, wasn't as well established. And often the advice you'd get would be, if you wanted to work in psychological area as a therapist or whatever, you're really better off to be a psychiatrist or move through medical school and so on. So I got caught up in that, which was a complete no-go for me, really, because it wasn't what I was interested in. I mean, I was doing a whole bunch of stuff that I wasn't really interested in. So I took
But you didn't know that until you...
No, until I'd done
it. Put your foot in the water.
Yeah, which is fine. So I had that time catching up on the pre-med work, which I did at the college, in, but also I was still looking at possibilities of postgrad work in psychology.
So how did you fund it then, if you were studying?
I had a scholarship from them, very, very generous scholarship from the college that sort of did everything, and enough, my needs were modest and perfectly well looked after. And likewise, at Harvard, and then it was a year master's, which was great. It was all coursework, and so it was very concentrated. And then I got my, I then looked around for jobs, and the first job was in Ottawa in Canada, at Carleton University, and so there off I went to that.
And what were you doing there?
I was a lecturer in psychology, and then I had a year at McGill University Medical School after that, which again, you know, I thought I wanted to do the medicine, and that was clear that I wasn't, that wasn't my thing, and so I then applied for jobs and in psychology, and on the basis of the master's I was getting offers throughout the states. I could have gone to a number of different places, but I thought, well, there was a delay in getting my immigration transfer to the United States, and I had about 4 months sort of which nothing to do particularly, and no, you know, not really much in the way of income. So I thought, well, I'll just go back to New Zealand and have a little holiday and so on. And meanwhile, this other thing will come through. And at that point, then I got my Massey thing. And I also had an offer from the Michigan University.
Your Massey thing?
Yeah. Well, I applied to Massey for a job, okay, which I got.
So,
yeah.
So how old were you? You'd done a fair bit of studying by then. How old were
you?
Yeah,
I was about 24, 25, something like that. Yeah. And it was interesting because the baby boomers were coming through, and it was a good time actually to be looking for jobs in academia, because I sort of predated the baby, you know, boomers, and so I was kind of that much ahead of them, but they needed, you know, they were coming in droves to the universities.
Yeah. Well, the students didn't have to pay fees back in those days, yeah, either, no, did they? So that sort of gave
big demand.
Really, yeah.
You're talking about 1967.
Yes. Yeah.
So that was one of the very early days of Massey as a university.
It was indeed a Massey, and we were, interestingly, I had four different venues for my office when I was at Massey. And the first one was Cashabirch, and then we were moved. We went to the old premises of the Victoria University, which are now standing idle in Hokowhitu, and we then went to Whararata, where I have many memories of Whararata, where we meet as Rotarians. My office was there, and I did all my lecturing, all my lectures and tutorials and so on were in the back of the Whararata. And then we went into the Social Science Tower, and it was when I was in the Social Science Tower that I got my next move to back to Canada again.
I'll throw in an anecdote there. Yeah. I came to Massey in 1978 from England.
Yeah.
And there's a sign at the bottom of the Social Science Tower saying first occupied, and I think it was 1972.
Yeah.
Given all the student protests and stuff at the time I was at university, the idea of a university building saying first occupied was...
Yeah. Anyway. Yes, that's right. But it was generally a good time. The only thing I didn't like at Massey of the day was it was very authoritarian in some ways, some respects, because you had to go and get permission to get two copies. If you wanted to photocopy something, you had to apply to the head of the department.
And it was your namesake who was the Vice-Chancellor then?
Dr. Stewart, that's right. Yeah. Actually, I'm wondering whether I should give us a brief anecdote about Dr. Stewart. Why not? I was, as I say, with my experience, I've sort of got a bit of a perhaps unusual combination of entrepreneurship and academia. And so I was always, you know, looking for academic, entrepreneurial things. And I sort of got into the property thing. And the Massey is to blame for me getting into the property thing, because when I arrived, they said, look, we will give you a 90% guarantee to buy a house in Palmerston North. And so I was a bachelor at the time. So I said, well, is it possible for me to build two units? And I'm a bachelor, I don't have any family or anything. I'll live in the one unit and then I'll rent the other. So I duly did this and built. I got commissioned to be built, and they provided a 90% guarantee, and the cost of building was much less than actually what I received in money. So I actually made money on building this thing, and I, as much money as I earned as a lecturer for the first year. Mm. I'd made in one real estate deal, and it was totally painless, and I also had a house to live in. And I sort of got in Palmerston North. I had quite extensive holdings. And actually, there's another lecturer and myself, and I won't identify who he was. We kind of teamed up, and we had quite a lot of properties around Palmerston North, which didn't intrude on what we were doing. We were all doing our Massey, certainly wasn't being shortchanged, but we got a lot of fun out of it, and it was actually did quite well.
Mm. I'd like to leave that particular subject just there at this stage, Bob, because there are a couple of other things I would like to go back to. Mm-hmm. You commented about your boarding school years, that you didn't really enjoy them very much at all.
No.
Could you just elaborate and think why and what happened?
I think part of the, in those who heard the first recording, my father died when I was 7, and which was a very tragic event, because I felt, even though as a very young child, I was very close to him. So my mother remarried when I was 12, and I got shipped off to boarding school, probably in the way a bit, you know, and we all did, actually, my sister and brother. So I probably didn't get a very good introduction to being shipped off kind of thing to a very...
So what sort of age were you then?
I was early teens, sort of 13, something like that. Yeah. So, and I wasn't the right personality for... it was all sport, and I'm not particularly good at sport. In fact, I'm bloody hopeless at sport. But so that was kind of not a good thing, actually, if you're in that situation. I've got the gift of the gab, and I'm quite resourceful and quite smart, and so I sort of avoided some of the worst things that could have happened to me.
Would you say you were bullied, or?
I generally managed to sort of find some way out of it, but I think probably. It didn't help me that I had this hatred of sport.
Yeah.
I mean, it's quite interesting. Here I am, I'm 83 years old, and I will go and turn off the sports thing. I have such a strong aversion to sport.
Mm.
And actually, my wife, Catherine, is a very sporty lady. You know, she was actually, when she was young, she was a brilliant athlete. But she unfortunately had an accident, but so she quite often wants to hear it. But anyway, it's funny, these things. But so I didn't. It wasn't a very good match. But more fundamentally, it was a pretense. It encouraged my interest in secondary education, because I had a horrible experience at Christ College, but I had a wonderful experience when I went on my year in America as an AFS scholar.
And roughly what sort of age were you then?
I was about 17.
17,
yeah. And that contrast proved to be very productive to me in terms of thinking about. And I wrote a book on adolescence in New Zealand, which was used as a text for a number of years. And one of them was actually, I talked about how I had got this interest in adolescence, and how do we get adolescents to be the best that they can be? You know, that's always been my passion. You know, how do you create the conditions, whether you're a parent or a teacher, to help people to flower, help their personalities to flower, you know, rather than being like flowers that sort of wilt? How do you actually encourage them? How do you do that? Well, I think that you've got to actually, I mean, it sounds corny, but really look for what they're doing right. You know, find people doing something right and then praise them. I mean, you can't go much beyond that, really. And I think teachers now realise that much more, I think. I mean, there's been, it's actually quite heartening to see how much more humane and, well, not just humane, but how much more effective and how much more smart teachers are. You know, because why would you want to be a teacher trying to help children, young people to grow, and not be smart about how you do that? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, why would you do stuff that actually works against what you're supposed to be doing?
So how does that equate with the reported dropping in standards at schools?
Well, it depends how you assess what are the objectives of... I mean, it seems to me, yes, the academic, and I'm not convinced that it's a material drop anyway, but in academic standards... But that's not the only criteria. The most important criteria is, are people, as a result of their adolescence and their schooling, able to live a productive life where they feel good about themselves and they are good to others? You know, because a lot of conflict that in marriages and in society generally are when people are basically stunted emotionally, and there should, you know, it just makes sense for society to be more sensible about how you actually create people who are in themselves content, that they can deal with stress effectively. And there are many good, this is why I have very great passion about how to communicate the abilities to reduce stress and to deal with frustrating situations, which is all, it's all a skill. And it's actually not... And a lot of the stuff that I've developed myself, I've never read in anywhere. And so one of my life goals now is actually to write that stuff down. I use... well, for example, whenever I feel stressed, I actually stop breathing. Sounds quite bizarre, but I hold my breath for as long as I possibly can and then exhale, and it's as though the body's saying, hey, what are you doing? You've got to keep breathing, you know. I mean,
you do this intentionally.
Intentionally. Oh, right. I deliberately stop breathing. I just breathe normally and then I stop breathing. And I mean, after all, people who do diving can actually hold their breath for quite a considerable period, and you can do that. Eventually your lungs are trying to force their way in and out, trying to force you to bring in breath, and then eventually it's a sort of a survival thing that the body is in a self-preservation mode, and it cuts off all of the sort of unnecessary kind of stuff that you're doing. And I find it totally reduces stress. And then eventually, and then you take a breath, and then you find then that you're on your whole level of emotional arousal, whether it's being upset or has gone to a lower level. So
is that like, I seem to recall the idea of you've got a young child who's throwing a tantrum or whatever, yes, and you just say, okay, take a deep breath,
yeah,
and just wait. Is that
the advice they seem to give is that you should breathe, and I think that's actually wrong. I've seen it in a lot of these sort of self-help books. I think what they should be doing is doing what I do, because if you're a runner and you've got to get out there and you get as much oxygen into yourself by breathing, and so in other words you're into fight or flight motion. But if you're actually trying to cut down on that adrenaline overload, the thing to do is to actually bring it down so that you're in a kind of meditative, almost sleeping type of mode, and then the body can kind of recover itself, you know, and you don't get that adrenaline rush which you need in many cases in an emergency, we need that adrenaline rush, but you don't need it that over. So that's where the passion about psychology is, in that it's so important to for people to actually know this stuff, you know, because it makes. I mean, particularly in a state in a time where there's huge anxiety and huge stress in sort of just the news we get, and let alone the people who are suffering all of this in Ukraine and so on, and these having these skills, of course, it doesn't. It just enables people to deal with stress and challenging situations much better than they otherwise would. You know.
That's interesting, because you know, quite often, as you say, when a child takes a tantrum, their parents or the mother or father will say to them, you know, just take a deep breath, just take a deep breath. And you're saying, no, don't take a deep breath. You're saying, exhale.
That's right, exhale and hold it. Yeah.
Which is quite different.
It is different.
Yeah. Well, can I just, call that one to a little bit of a halt at the moment and just talk about, or if you could talk about the effect your father's death had on you and the things that you did from there.
Well, as I said,
you were a young boy at the time.
I was a young boy, and he was sick for. I was from my. He died at my age seven, and he was sick for 2 years, and so I was really five. Was it? But I can remember his job was teaching a distance education through the correspondence school. He went round to farm children, and he was very, very dedicated. And he would have had be just totally. In sync with me in terms of the bringing the best out of people. You know, this was his whole philosophy, and we, even though for just a short time, we benefited from that. I mean, an example of this is he was quite fascinated with grafting fruit trees, and I would have been all of 2.5 or 3, and I was absolutely entranced by this, you know, and he was explaining, you know, what he was doing, and I was really interested in this, and it's one of the most vivid memories in my life is that interaction, and lots of things like that where he was able to cultivate the curiosity of a very young child, and just make you excited about the world. I mean, he was a natural teacher.
Right.
He was. Which is what a teacher should be able to do, is just create that magic about teaching.
So by the time you were around about 12, you had been able to see the fruits of those graftings.
Yes, and that was quite precious.
Yes, I was going to say.
To see that, you know, that I'd done that with him, and I've got pictures of him with in Timaru with the little boats that they had, you know, and, you know, it was really... And then, sadly, as I say, my mother got remarried, and the chap that she remarried was not. We had nothing in common, basically.
Oh, okay.
He was just an oaf, basically.
Did he have a farming background?
He was a farmer. He was born on the farm, and done nothing else. But his son, because my stepbrother is. Actually, we get along extremely well, and he somehow got the. My mother was also very sensitive, and she was a painter, and she's been a wonderful mum, you know, for us all, for her three children, and also for her fourth child, which was John. And John and I get along very well, and he somehow managed to combine the best of his. He's a very good farmer, and he's produced three sons who are all committed to being farmers.
Oh, right.
They're all there, and they've all found wives, and they went to Lincoln. They've all got degrees in agriculture, and they're really quite onto it. He travelled. When I came back from my AFS scholarship. He said, he's told me, John has, that that was what triggered his interest in travel. And he and his wife, she's married to a Dutch lady, and they've travelled all over the place, you know, with camper vans, and they're still doing it. I mean, he's, and the three sons are a delight. They and their wives, we have a very good relationship with them. So, but the dad, he was a little bit of a limited person, I have to say, in fairness.
This is part 2 of 4. Tune in next week for part 3.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you're a fan of NPR, listening to our podcasts and live stream has never been easier. Just search for accessmedia.nz on the App Store or Google Play and download the app with the kiwifruit logo. Once you've got it, pick Manawatu People's Radio from the list of stations and go find your new favourite show.